From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Veteran journalist Don Lattin writes in his new memoir that he spent years worshiping at the altar of drugs and alcohol, not the type of devotion you might expect from a religion writer. The book Distilled Spirits intertwines Lattin's own history with biographical sketches of three others who mix spiritual seeking with mind-altering substances: Brave New World author Aldous Huxley, Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill Wilson, and philosopher Gerald Hurd. Lattin will join us in studio for Forum's next hour. You're invited to join us as well after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Veteran religion writer and Bay Area-based author Don Lattin joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. He's the author of the Harvard Psychedelic Club, Jesus Freaks, Following Our Bliss, and Shopping for Faith. And his latest book is Distilled Spirits, Getting High, Then Sober with a Famous Writer, a Forgotten Philosopher, and a Hopeless Drunk. And he's here in studio with us wearing what I thought was his athletic shirt. It's green and yellow. Congratulations to the A's, by the way. But it says atheist instead. You got a one-liner that goes with that?
I do. I'm not really an atheist, Michael, but I do root for them sometimes. So
that's a good line. Let's get right into this book, because normally when people think of lysergic acid, I mean, they think of Timothy Leary, and they have all kinds of associations
right.
with good trips or bad trips or whatever. Don't necessarily think of the spiritual quest side of it or the religious side of it.
Yeah, well, a lot of the explorations in the 60s, I think, was about people trying to have some kind of a spiritual connection. But what I write about in Distilled Spirits is I really go back a decade to look at the use of LSD by therapists and researchers and other explorers of consciousness back in the 1950s. And people this was when people didn't think of LSD then like they do now. This was before Timothy Leary. LSD was legal, for one thing, and it was seen as a promising tool to help psychologists understand both mental illness and more positive states of altered consciousness. And
one as ecstasy would be later to some degree, huh?
Yeah, ecstasy later on. Ecstasy was legal for a while, I mean, in the 80s.
And as you say, so was LSD.
Yeah, LSD was legal until 1966, and people forget that. And it had a whole other association earlier on in the 50s when people like Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, was experimenting with it to see if it could help alcoholics.
We didn't know it was being put in our water, for example, by the CIA.
Yeah. No, all kinds of people were trying to find something to do with it, including the CIA. Yeah.
It's also... actually, when I talked about its connection to religion and spirituality, the three figures you write about really in some ways epitomize that. I mean, Huxley, everybody who was in that search in the 60s knows about his trying to open up portals to consciousness. But what they don't know is the connection of people like Bill W., who founded Alcoholics Anonymous, or, like you say, the forgotten philosopher Gerald Hurd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What I do in this book is I try to tell the story of these three visionaries, Aldous Huxley, Gerald Hurd, and Bill Wilson, who crossed paths in California in the 1940s. And each of these guys are fascinating in their own way, but when we look at how their lives came together in the 40s and then into the 50s when they were experimenting with LSD and on into the 60s, where they really, I think, laid the foundation for they really helped transform the landscape of religion and spirituality in the 1960s. A lot of these changes we're still living with now.
We're talking about Huxley coming out to California with Hurd in the 30s.
Yeah. Actually, Gerald Hurd and Aldous Huxley came together on the same ship from London in 1937. Huxley with his wife Maria, and Hurd, who's gay, with his lover Christopher Wood. And they came on a pacifist speaking tour. They didn't expect to stay here. Well, they wound up living the rest of their lives in Southern California and became known, along with the writer Christopher Isherwood, as the British mystical expatriates of Southern California. I think they were given that name by Alan Watts, by the way, who was another Brit who came over here.
And another seeker and Buddhist.
Another seeker.
Actually, we've got some cuts here. And one of the fascinating things about hearing Huxley speak is just hearing his voice. This is a cut from Aldous Huxley talking in an old radio interview about LSD.
I think it would be extremely good for almost anybody with fixed ideas and with a great certainty about what's what. To take this thing and to realize that the world he has constructed is by no means the only world, that there are these extraordinary other types of universe which we may inhabit and which we should be very grateful for inhabiting, I think.
Yeah, he was pretty jazzed about it, to put it mildly, wasn't he?
Yeah. You know, Huxley first took mescaline, not LSD, mescaline, a similar psychedelic drug, in his home in the Hollywood Hills in the spring of 1953, which was pretty early, with an LSD researcher who he sought out and invited to stay at his house. He wanted to try this so much. And, of course, the next year he wrote a book based on – a long essay, really, based on his mescaline experience called The Doors of Perception, which had all kinds of ramifications later on in the 50s and 60s, one of which was Jim Morrison loved the book and called his band The Doors, based on The Doors of Perception. But yeah, Huxley, I think, you know, like I say, before Leary and Ram Dass and Ken Kesey and all these people, Gerald Hurd and Aldous Huxley and Bill Wilson really, I think, launched the psychedelic 60s.
Well, they're also talking – in fact, we've got some other cuts and we might as well just hear these. And by the way, this is also a book about – Don Latton's experiences with drugs and worshiping in the altar of drugs and going through. And want to talk about that as well, because fortunately he's been sober for 5 years and
six.
Six. Congratulations. But that in itself is a real odyssey and a journey, and may have something to impart in the way of wisdom vis-a-vis overcoming addictions. In fact, does. But I thought we'd hear. Actually, Danny, I thought we'd hear the cut from Gerald Hurd. Let's just talk about Hurd first, because this is a guy that many people haven't heard of. I mean, he is, as you say, the forgotten philosopher.
Yes. Yes.
But a very important figure, an Anglo-Irish figure, gay, as you said, and who established himself as one of these leading advocates when things were just being put in place in terms of exploring these outer realms of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And one or two people have said to me, I've said it to myself, that's what death is going to be like. And oh, what fun it will be.
How do you mean that?
Well, I mean that there are the colors and the beauties, the designs, the beautiful way things appear. People themselves, dull people that I thought dull, appear fascinating, interesting, mysterious, wonderful. But that's only the beginning. Men were saying it this afternoon who was taking it. Suddenly you notice that there aren't these separations, that we're not on a separate island shouting across to somebody else and trying to hear what they're saying and misunderstanding them. You know, you use the word yourself, empathy. This thing's flowing underneath. We're parts of a single continent. It meets underneath the water. And with that goes such delight, the sober certainty of waking bliss.
He's talking about LSD, and it almost romanticizes LSD, all that sense of unity and transcendence and sober certainty of waking bliss. Follow your bliss, said Joseph Campbell a number of years later.
Right.
And this was, and there was, you know, serious backlash when people were having bad trips and when LSD was looked upon as being, a bad drug. But at this point, it was almost rapture.
Yeah, well, you have to remember that these people were taking LSD with a supervising psychiatrist. They were prepared. They were in a safe place. Also, they knew it, in fact, was LSD, which you don't know when you buy drugs on the street. Yeah, I really try not to romanticize LSD and other drugs in the book, because I've had my own very bad trips and experiences with them. But you know, the fact is, I think the vast majority of people who took psychedelic drugs back in the 60s and 70s, an estimated 23 million people, by the way, had positive experiences, and they didn't become drug addicts or insane. I mean, a few did, but not necessarily because of the LSD. Could be a contributing factor. But I think most people look back on it as a positive experience, a very profound experience in their lives. I certainly do, for the most part.
I think it's still a split decision in terms of stories I hear from people. Mm-hmm. But Hurd was a kind of an odd character. I mean, this is a guy who was he was celibate, and he was actually advocating celibacy, and had a friendship with Huxley that went awry.
Well, a bit. Yeah, they had a brief period, sort of a lull in their friendship. But no, they were very close for most of their lives. Yeah, Gerald Hurd was a fascinating character. He was an Anglo-Irish writer and mystic. He was the original science correspondent for BBC Radio back in the 20s. That's when he met Huxley in 1929. He wrote about 40 books, deep philosophical tomes, two weird mystery tales. He was gay. He wrote some of the first essays about gay spirituality way back under the pseudonym D.B. Vest. I'm not sure exactly why he chose that name.
Remains obscure.
But he wrote the first popular book about flying saucers in the 1950s. He was really, I call him kind of the secret godfather of the New Age movement. He really laid the foundation for a lot of that stuff.
And he did have this close relationship with Huxley. And Bill Wilson, Huxley, and Hurd in the 40s and 50s were pretty positive about LSD. I think that's really one of the points here. But Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, felt it could help alcoholics.
Yeah, and he wasn't the only one. I mean, before Bill Wilson ever tried LSD, which was the first time in the summer of 1956, there was lots of research going on to find beneficial uses of LSD to treat depression and alcoholism. That's one of the reasons he got interested in it. There was existing research, and it was showing positive results in treating alcoholism. I recently found a letter that just surfaced, a letter that Bill Wilson wrote to Carl Jung, where he just goes on and on about how much success AA was having using LSD, the letter that was, I think, later suppressed by Alcoholics Anonymous, which I just recently uncovered.
Well, Huxley and Hurd turned Bill Wilson onto LSD, and the world lit up for him. It seized him, I think, in his words. We've actually got him speaking from a recently released documentary, Bill W., and maybe you can set this up.
Yeah, this quote is actually not about LSD. This quote is about a revelation that Wilson had when he bottomed out in the 1930s at Towns Hospital in New York. Interesting thing about that, though, the treatment that they had at the hospital was called the belladonna cure, and belladonna can actually be a hallucinogen. So it turns out that Bill's original revelation may have partly been induced by another early psychotropic drug.
But he was addicted his whole life to tobacco, to sex, and alcohol. I mean, he was howling supposedly for alcohol, as you put it, on his deathbed.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I don't want to make too much of that. He was, you know, probably delirious. You know, he was dying. And that just shows the power that alcohol can have on some people's lives. He did not drink on his deathbed. But, you know, we have to give him, I think, a little slack for that. You know, he was basically delirious.
But the idea of a spiritual awakening or something spiritual to fill that emptiness that is filled with booze or filled, I mean, that's a lot of what AA was about and still is about.
Yeah. Bill Wilson didn't really feel comfortable in his own skin until he started drinking. And I write about the book my own experiences, and I had a similar you know, feeling that I always felt like I was the, you know, the funniest and the smartest guy in the room when I had a few. And, you know, I drank and used drugs for years. And I had a great time over the years. I'm not going to apologize for it, but at a certain point it caught up to me, and I write about some of my struggles later on with alcohol, and especially with cocaine. That was the drug that got me, not LSD or alcohol, but really the cocaine that got to me.
And you write very movingly about your struggles. And before we hear this cut from Bill W. from the recently released documentary, which I wanted listeners to hear, maybe you can comment on, well, you say you liked it, and a lot of people really like the feeling of getting high. They like who they are when they're high and everything.
Of course.
Yeah. But then you sink, and you continue to sink, and the sense of getting sober again becomes a real struggle.
Yeah. I mean, like I say, I used to use drugs and alcohol as a social lubricant, like I think a lot of people do. But for me, that story ended with me more or less hiding in my basement with a bottle of vodka and a pile of cocaine and actually writing one of my books in that state. not one of my best-selling books either. The first book I wrote sober with the Harvard Psychedelic Club was the first one that really sold. So there you go right there.
But how hard it is to work for the Chronicle as a reporter and to afford cocaine is a pretty expensive habit.
You know, I blame HarperCollins. They gave me a ridiculously large advance for my second book, which basically bombed. But so
HarperCollins, they're culpable for all that stuff you put up your nose. What kind of wisdom do you have to impart just in terms of your own personal struggles and what you went through with addiction?
Well, you know, I don't know if I have any wisdom necessarily, you know, to impart. I mean, I'm not writing this, but I'm not proselytizing for AA. I mean, some people will be upset that I even mentioned that I have been involved with AA, that I may be violating the principle of anonymity. I think this is my own story, and I have a right to tell it. I'm a writer. That's what I do. But, you know, for me, it was just finding another way to open up, another way to find some kind of compassion and greater awareness in my life. And I've done that through not just for the recovery groups, but also with some spiritual groups and meditation groups, which I've been involved with. You know, I wrote about religion for 25 years for the Chronicle, earlier for the Examiner. And I didn't really get serious about my own spiritual search until I left the God beat. I found it easier to do once I was away from the newspaper.
But did you think sometimes that you were sort of looking for God with especially things like LSD? And
oh, yeah. I write in the book, there's a chapter called Psychedelic in the book where I write about an experience I had my freshman year at UC Berkeley, where I did, I think, see God as I understand him on LSD, like a lot of people back in those days.
You sure it was him, not her.
It was sort of more like the white light. I don't think it was sort of gender neutral.
Let's hear Bill W. again. This is a clip from Bill Wilson speaking from a recently released documentary, Bill W.
And then it seemed that room lit up in a great glare. I was transported into an ecstasy. It seemed that I stood on the top of a mountain and a great clean wind was blowing. Not of air, but of spirit. And I was free. At length, of course, I realize I'm still on the bed. But I am in a different world. A great peace has settled down. Well, for me, that was the beginning of feeling that everything was completely all right. That indeed now I was a part of life at last. That I had touched the ultimate reality of a loving God.
Well, he found God.
He did, and he was at least an agnostic before he bottomed out on alcohol at Towns Hospital. I think he even used the word atheist to describe himself at times. And, you know, that's what it takes for a lot of people. I've written about religion for a long time, and I've talked to a lot of people who had religious conversions, and it's usually there's some crisis in their life, some transition in their life, which leads them to open up and start looking at the universe in a different way. And that certainly happened in a dramatic way for Bill Wilson.
It's also one of the things, time and time again, you read about people are able to give up addiction because they find or they feel the sense of God.
Well, actually, the title of the book, Distilled Spirits, comes from another letter that Jung wrote to Wilson, where he points out that that a lot of hardcore drunks or addicts need that spiritual awakening. And the word, spiritus in Latin refers to both alcohol, which can be a depraving poison for some people, and a sublime religious experience. So as a religion reporter, I find that very interesting. Religion reporter and an addict, I find that very interesting. And a lot of what I write about in the book is the connection between the spiritual search and various substances that produce altered states of consciousness. And that's what I was writing about in the Harvard Psychedelic Club a lot as well.
It's been a sort of recurring motif in your work. And there's also the sense of what was the great biography of Michelangelo? It was called The Agony and the Ecstasy. That's kind of what we're talking about here.
That certainly describes my experiences with both LSD and with alcohol and cocaine. And Huxley called psychedelics heaven and hell drugs. They can lead to ecstasy and they can also unleash agony. And I think that's very true.
Well, again, we're talking to Don Latin. Distilled Spirits is his new book. And he, in his research, actually discovered some videotape. Why don't you set this up for us? This woman, I think you call her a June Cleaver type of woman.
June Cleaver on acid, yeah. Yeah. This is some rare footage that I uncovered. It's an old CBS television show called Focus on Sanity, about mental health issues. And on the program, Sidney Cohen, who is the researcher who turned Bill Wilson on, along with Gerald Hurd, on the video, and Hurd's on this video too, they interview this woman, and then they give her a clear liquid, a glass of clear liquid to it, containing her lysergic acid, as he puts it.
And we're talking about roughly mid-50s, yeah?
Yeah, 1956. Yeah. As a writer, this was great because this is the same room where Bill Wilson took LSD, the same year. So I was able to see exactly what it looked like. And she goes from this very normal, 50s housewife to sounding like a hippie, acid queen in the 60s. And what's interesting is she had no idea how she was supposed to sound. She had no idea what LSD was going to do. But you'll hear, the transformation this woman goes through.
And she is a Southern California school teacher, we should mention. Let's hear her.
Yes.
This is a glass of water, colorless, tasteless. It contains 100 gamma of LSD-25, one-tenth of a milligram, the equivalent of 1/600th of a grain. An ounce of this material will make 150,000 such doses. Let us observe the effect some 3 hours later.
Well, tell me.
Well, I just couldn't. I couldn't possibly tell you. It's here. Can't you feel it? This whole room. This everything is in color, and I can feel the air. I can see it. I can see all the molecules. I'm part of it. Can't you see it?
Seems so often, in the three that you profile, and we might talk about why this trinity, in their experiences and this June Cleaver-type housewife, it's that sense of things not being separate, of things being unified.
Yeah.
That's the trip.
Is the trip, and I think it's a... I'm certain it's a classic mystical experience that she's having. The awe, the wonder, the transcendence, the immanence, the unity. She later on, she has such compassion.
And there's aesthetics too, though, involved.
Yeah.
Seeing beauty and colors.
Like a lot of people say, well, that's not a real religious experience because it was drug-induced. Well, my opinion is the experience people have on psychedelic drugs, it is an authentic religious experience in the sense of the brain chemistry is the same. You might have the same experience from meditating or sensory deprivation or fasting. But the important question to me is not about the experience. What do you do with the experience? Does it make you a better person? Do you leave? What happens the morning after? And that's in terms of a full religious experience, I think what's important. My friend Houston Smith, the scholar of world religions, who did a lot of experimentation with psychedelics too, with Timothy Leary, he says it's about altered traits, not altered states.
I know it sounds, you and I have both read our William James. It sounds like a religious experience to me. I mean, what she's describing.
Yeah, well, funny you should mention William James, because after Bill Wilson had his experience at Towns Hospital in 1934, the first thing he did, a friend visited him and gave him a copy of The Varieties of Religious Experience. Wilson says he read this the morning after his revelation that resulted in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you can see, James, the whole thing about AA, searching for – people have to find God as we understand him or her, we would add now. That is – so many people actually have that sense of the divine now. People say they're spiritual but not religious. A third of Americans today say they're spiritual but not religious. And there are all kinds of reasons for that, but I think three of the reasons are Aldous Huxley, Gerald Hurd, and Bill Wilson.
We're talking about those three that Don Letton has selected, his trinity, as I put it, but it's also his story in many respects and his addiction. And you might want to join this conversation, talk about effective drugs and overcoming addiction and religious experience. We're kind of got a big canvas here, but be interested in hearing from listeners who have had LSD experiences. Were they good experiences? Were they bad experiences? How do you look back on them? And please feel free to join us. I remember after John Lennon died, I got a lot of calls. I was at another radio station at the time, and people were saying, he glorified LSD. This is a horrible thing he did. And yet people were also saying, yeah, he did a lot on that score that was positive. Join us, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, veteran journalist, religion writer, and Bay Area author. Don Letton is here with us in studio. He wrote a new memoir and wrote in the memoir that he spent years, quote, worshiping at the altar of drugs and alcohol. And that's perhaps not the type of devotion you might expect from a religion writer. But the book that he's produced most recently is called Distilled Spirits, and it intertwines his own story with biographical sketches of three others who mix spiritual seeking with mind-altering substances: Brave New World author Aldous Huxley, Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill Wilson, and philosopher Gerald Hurd. He's with us in studio this hour, and we're talking about addiction, about how drugs as a spiritual launching point, perhaps, or more than just a launching point, a place to find enlightenment, and LSD and LSD experiences. And the connection between drugs and religion has certainly come up here. And here's Red, who writes on our web page: "Religion is escapism from reality, and so are drugs. Both religion and drugs sell something that ultimately fails to deliver." Now, that's a point of view. Some of you may have a very different point of view. Tim in an email writes, "Your guest bottoms out on cocaine. Okay, aren't most harmful chemicals derived by men in a lab where many positive chemicals are made by nature? Consider levels of addiction." Mm-hmm. Fair point. There's a new wave of psychedelics, by the way. Some of them FDA and even DEA approved, at least experimenting with psychedelics?
Yeah, there was a huge backlash, the whole war on drugs after Timothy Leary in the 60s, but not just a backlash against street use. There was a backlash against legitimate, you know, scientific research to find some beneficial uses for these powerful substances. And there's a whole new wave of, like I say, FDA, DEA-approved research. One of the most interesting studies is using MDMA, known as ecstasy, on the street to treat returning Iraqi and Afghan war veterans suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And there's some very positive findings. And these are like scientific, you know, studies that are written in, you know, medical scientific journals. I mean, it's not the kind of stuff Leary was doing back in the 60s.
Yeah, we did a whole show on it. I think it's still in our archives, which is at kqed.org. And by the way, you can post any questions or comments you have by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment, or communicating with us on our Facebook page, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And let me give out the phone number. Do grab a line when it becomes available and join this conversation at 866-733-6786. And just a couple of events that are of interest here. Actually, Saturday at 6 o'clock, Don Latin and I will be together talking about, well, spirituality and agnosticism, among other things. That's October 6th at 6 p.m. at 582 Market. And you can, that's still part of Litquake, by the way. You can go to litquake.org, and I don't know if tickets are still available, but at least if they are, that's where to go. Let's go to your calls, and we begin, Joan, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I live in Oakland. I used psychedelics in the late 60s. I found them amazingly revelatory. I wanted to use it with a therapist I had who was afraid to do it for, you know, obvious reasons. But I think generally we file, you know, our ideas and so on are filed in file folders and, you know, in cabinets and so on. And it's the way I felt. It's as if all of those separations just disappear. So it brings together things that you might not have thought of otherwise. And I just thought it was a real revelation. It led me to appreciate different kinds of music that I never would have even listened to. And it had a profound influence on my life.
All right. I thank you for that testament. I remember many years ago interviewing Ram Dass, and he said to me, "I honor what LSD did for me." And I was interested, of course, in the word honoring. but there were many who recoiled and who continue to recoil because of what you just mentioned about the 60s and about, you know, tales of people jumping out of windows with bad trips. And I remember Art Linkletter's daughter. I interviewed Timothy Leary, and Art Linkletter's daughter had just apparently committed suicide on a bad trip. And I guess I was getting pretty interrogating. And from his point of view, he so it's probably the only time I was called the Nazi Reagan of San Francisco. But the truth of the matter is that many people have these understandably very apprehensive and concerned associations with specifically LSD.
Yeah, LSD is a very, very powerful drug that can make you psychotic. And it can also make you have a sublime mystical experience. And those are, in some ways, those are, you know, two sides of the same coin. And I think that people need to be very – I'm not advocating drug use at all. I mean, I don't take drugs at all anymore, including alcohol. But, you know, I think that these drugs are taken. They should be – you should know what it is. You should be in a very safe place, people you can trust. I mean, that's kind of what one of the things Leary and Albert Ramdas were talking about. You know, set and setting is an important – and expectations you have, an intention you have going into this.
And the right dose. I mean, if you're going to take it.
Yeah, and the right dose, and knowing that you actually are taking what you think you're taking. If you buy it on the street, you never know.
We bring John on as our next caller. John, join us. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Very interesting conversation. Thank you. I look forward to the book. I'm wondering, having been one who has tried the Wonder Drug and benefited from it, I have been a student of Buddhism and Christianity and studied religions and philosophies and came across, of course, Thomas Merton, who was very interested in pursuing the information about LSD. He was a correspondent with Huxley, and also some, I believe, still unpublished letters between Merton and Gary Snyder, the California master poet and Buddhist. And I wanted to make
and leading one point. Ecologist and environmental thinker.
Right, of course. I want to make one point about the whole link letter thing, too, you know. It was later found out that her boyfriend was present. She suffered from multiple trauma injuries, and not 15 years later, the same boyfriend had an argument with his girlfriend, the actress Carol Wayne, in Mexico, and she was found dead. So the LSD thing with Linkletter, it was just one of his right-wing anti-drug excuses. It was emotional for him, which makes sense, but it's been proven that it's not true.
Yeah, well, at the time...
I'll let that later rest.
Well, at the time it was... Yeah, no, thank you for that codification. That's that is important. At the time it was certainly bandied about as being true. It was written about
in
a newspaper.
Yeah, plus she wasn't... I don't think it was even said that she was actually on necessarily LSD at the time. I mean, she probably could have had some other mental issues that LSD exasperated. And so, you know,
and it did heighten, it did heighten some mental.
It can, but who knows what really happened or why someone commits suicide? It's very hard to know.
Thank you so much, John, for the call. Do you know about Merton and LSD, though? John called.
I know a little bit, but I do know quite a bit about you know, the whole connection between Buddhism and recovery and addiction. When I first started trying to clean up my act, I was drawn to Buddhism. I was already drawn to Buddhism, and I, you know, the Buddhism teaches about, you know, our suffering being due to our attachment, our desire, our craving. What better description is that of an addictive state? So there's actually a whole interesting recovery network, Buddhist recovery network now, using some of the principles from the 12-step movement, but looking at it from a Buddhist perspective.
Isn't there also a 12-step program now for agnostics and atheists? They don't talk about higher power. They use different language. Excuse me.
Yeah, well, there are all kinds of secular, recovery groups out there.
But Bill W. had that definite higher power in there.
Oh, God as you understand him yourself, and you could also – it can be anything. I mean, it could be – some people consider God the group of drunks, G-O-D, and that's all they need, the power of the group. And that's – to me, for me – the strength of the fellowship you find when you get into recovery. You start hanging out with a different crowd. You're not hanging out with your old, you know, drinking and drugging pals. The strength of fellowship and the redemptive power of storytelling. For me, that was what I think really helped me with my recovery. Not so much the God stuff or the 12 steps. It was, you know, you go to a 12-step meeting and people tell their story. And they find release and redemption in telling their story. And that's what I try to do in the book. In a way, the whole book is in working the steps in a very public way.
How did you feel about that? I mean, making all that
public? I didn't even intend to write a memoir. This book started out as a prequel to the Harvard Psychedelic Club, another group biography of three guys who I think were very important and influential in transforming the landscape of religion in this country. And my editor, actually, at University of California Press, who knew I had more than an academic interest in Bill Wilson and addiction, said, "Why don't you write from your personal experience? What do you find interesting about these three characters?" I hadn't written the book yet. I'd written a sample chapter. And that really freed me to write about myself in a way I never have before. You know, I'm old school. I was a journalist, you know, where I is a dirty word. It's not about you. You don't put yourself in your
even always
your
use
stories.
A passive voice when possible.
Yeah, you say this reporter or something, right. You know. So it was
observed.
Challenge at first. Yeah, right, exactly.
Let me get some more calls on, and Lisa joins us. Hi, Lisa.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Morning.
This just resonates with my views on universe and life and energy and spirit and everything. Of course, tuning in this morning, you know, just how perfect, because this subject, this area is so what's on my mind.
The universe must have been dictating you to tune in this morning.
Bam! Yeah. Bam.
Tune in, but don't turn on or drop out.
You know? You create your own reality. But I love this. I'm a member of AAA, and I have 18 months of sobriety, and I love the whole thing of fellowship and what it's meant to me. I'm a 49-year-old woman.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. But the fellowship, everything's great, and it's given me is the tools, and it's reawoken my own personal spiritual path, and that's what it is. And rather than to be like, you know, stuck to the group and everything else, it gave me the skills to get out my own 2 feet again, and I atone and how I go through the world rather than sitting around constantly in groups of drunks griping about the day. But that's a beautiful thing. Go if you need to go. Getting away from that, and I work now volunteering at my daughter's school, and I'm much more hands-on. I coach a couple sports teams, things like that. You know, and it's my chance to atone for my past stuff. Because that's what I've learned in my spiritual journey along the way, and coming down to, yes, I believe in God, but you can't peg me into everything because I think it's all lost in language completely, and that's what wars are about. The intelligence, the essence, the science, everything, all comes in from one, and we get lost in how we describe it in different languages, and that's why we run around getting angry and killing each other. And people have the right to believe in nothing and just believe in nothingness or, you know, whatever. It's anyway, I'm rambling.
We thank you for your ramble. It's enlightening. I was thinking about Democritus, who says nothing means more than nothing. The atonement she mentioned, though, I mean, that's all a part of the 12-step program, and that's often a part of going through the cleaning up process, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the 12-step program is really just another way of living out what Huxley would call in his book the perennial philosophy. I mean, the common kind of moral teachings that go through all religions, and forgiveness and, you know, making amends, apologizing, making amends for the sins of your past and the people you've hurt in your past. You know, people who...
Especially people you've hurt because of your addiction.
Yeah, people who become addicts, like heroin addicts or alcoholics, I mean, they leave an incredible trail of wreckage. And to deal with the psychological, you know, ramifications of all that is a huge part of recovery, and these groups help people do that.
You mentioned storytelling before. I want to get to more callers here and more find out what our listeners have to say. But I think you know, I'm a major fan and have been for many years of the writer Raymond Carver, who went through some pretty severe alcoholism. And you get the sense that the storytelling, I mean, it's cathartic on one level, but it's mm-hmm. also a sense of human connectedness that goes through, and it almost purges a kind of toxicity to just get rid of what you have to tell about yourself. Did you do that? Find that you were doing that in this writing about yourself?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, at first you do it maybe to a friend, or you might call this person a sponsor in recovery. Then you tell it to some of the people you've hurt. You tell your own story. You tell it in these meetings. And for me, I'm now telling it in a very public way in this book, which I know seems strange to some people. You get used to this confessional kind of tone when you're in recovery, and it shocks a lot of people in the real world to hear people talk like this, to be this brutally honest, to chronicle your own demons. But you know, Michael, you know, as a scholar of literature, when you write a memoir, you have to open up. You have to be honest. So you really have no choice, I think, when you write a memoir. And that's, you know, one reason why I didn't want to play around with the idea of calling myself Don L, or, you know, because some people in AA think you shouldn't tell your
story
publicly.
You've been getting some flack for that?
I thought I would get more so far. I haven't gotten all that much, a little bit. But I think, you know, the thing about AA or any of these groups is there are no rules, really. I mean, you know, they say the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking, you know, and so I meet their membership requirements.
Again, Don Latin here with us in studio. His new book is Distilled Spirits Getting High, Then Sober, with a famous writer, a forgotten philosopher, and a hopeless drunk. And let's go to more of your calls. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. I was struck by your show because I have also been in recovery for 7 years and didn't do a lot of LSD, but did do enough to be able to identify with a lot of the experiences that you talked about, including the experience of seeing the white light of God and seeing the devil in one trip.
What did he look like?
He looked like a guy I was talking to. He was embodied by the man I was talking to.
No horns or tail or anything?
No, but I knew he was the devil. I found myself saying, "Get behind me, Satan."
You're plagiarizing, but that's okay.
Right, of course. Illusion. It's an illusion.
Well, I appreciate hearing from you, and thank you for the call. We'll go to some more callers here. I want to go to some emails, too. Ben writes, I used LSD a few times in college, had some really mind-opening experiences, and then two bad trips, and I stopped. But I do think it was essential to my mental development, an open-mindedness, and a real peek into the power of perception. And on our Facebook, Don writes, I'm the creative director for a company, and I believe I owe much of my success to my many LSD experiences. There is a link between creativity and the use of LSD. Steve Jobs, for example, was verbose in giving credit to his acid experimentation during his formative years. And Max writes, my experiences with LSD as a late teenager and young adult are overwhelmingly positive. I found that the imperative need to manage my own insecurities and fears while under the influence of LSD led me to be more confident and even keeled person. It opened me to aesthetic appreciation, which is essential and invaluable. And there is also the whole oneness with the universe thing, but I'm sure others will talk plenty about that. But really, learning to be under the influence of LSD is an urban environment without letting anyone else realize that I was. All I can say is there is literally nothing else in my life that better taught me to keep my cool at all times. Now, this is a lot of testament in favor. I'm just taking these as they're coming in here. Russ says, I took way too many trips in high school, friends' basements, movie theaters, shopping mall. Bad idea. However, I did gain an appreciation for the fact that what we think of as reality is limited by our biological setup, and that helps us survive. But it's important to know it's not the only reality. Anybody who wants to try it out, though, like everybody has been saying, should do it in a safe, sane environment. And Mark says, Michael, please don't write off what Huxley was saying as the ramblings of an avuncular proto-hippie. What he was talking about was the experience that is the goal of advanced spiritual practice, the realization of a non-dual universe in which all things which appear to be separate are expressions of one great thing beyond good and bad, thing and no thing.
Yeah, that last comment is right on point. You know, Huxley was very influenced by the whole Vedanta movement, Huxley and Hurd, and they helped, and Christopher Isherwood even more so, and they helped popularize Vedanta in the United States in the 40s. And a lot of this is the idea, the conception of the divine that you find in the Vedas, in Hindu spirituality. And Huxley and Hurd were into that long before they took LSD. But the LSD allowed them to experience these states that they had read about, maybe in Hurd's case had a little taste of through meditation. He meditated 6 hours a day. Gerald Hurd was a fanatic about meditation. So there's definitely this is not just about drugs. It's really about religious experience, about mystical experience, and the caller said about getting beyond this dualistic thinking.
When the late Christopher Hitchens was on last on this program, he told that joke, which I'm sure you've heard, about, you know, the hot dog vendor in New York, and the guy says, I want one with everything. But that is often how people outline the experience. You feel one with the universe or feel one with everything around you. The subject and object merge, et cetera.
Right, right. You feel this kind of pattern that connects you with everything.
And that was
with
what Huxley wrote about.
Yeah, and this is really the idea of tantra in the Vedas. I mean, this is not something that was, you know, invented by a Swiss chemist. I mean, this is a human experience that people have been having for millennia.
The Brahman Atman, it's Sartori, it's all those things.
Yeah, the Tao, the clear light of the void, Brahman, the
but
Godhead.
They're all, and I don't mean Long Island here, they're all Eastern for the most part, really. I mean, in terms of their origins and their genesis. There's a lot of Christian mysticism.
You know, there's a lot, actually. There is a deep Christian mystical tradition which you don't hear much about, unfortunately, in the churches. I mean, there's a text called The Cloud of Unknowing. Medieval text, which sounds like something you'd find in Buddhism or Hinduism. It's there. You just have to look for it.
And there's the numinous, lest we forget.
Yes.
Which Hitchens and I also discussed. Lewis is our next caller. Lewis, you're on. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Michael and Don. Wanted to thank you for the really, really great show.
Thank you.
In high school, I was going down the path of alcoholism, primarily due to peer pressure, but when I got into college in 1966, I was lucky to room with someone who had experience with LSD, and after a trip or two, was able to give up alcohol completely and have been since then. And I heard something in 1968, which has stuck with me ever since, and a reporter asked a young Berkeley student what it was about psychedelic drugs that he liked so much. And his response was, it allows us to be the people we were meant to be. And that paralleled my experience as well. And I have never really understood the connection between having taken LSD as a teenager and the practice of Buddhism, but I've been a practicing Buddhist for 35 years now, and I can see how the Buddhist philosophy and the effects of LSD go together as a result of listening to the program this morning.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. But can you imagine, Don, if we were doing this program asking the same question about effective LSD in, say, Mississippi or Texas? We'd probably get a very different array of callers.
Well, you might be surprised. Yeah, this is the Bay Area, after all. This is where the summer of love and the human being and the Haight-Ashbury and all that. That last caller, though, reminded me of something that Huxley said when on his first mescaline trip. He said, this is how one ought to see. And that's very similar to what the caller just said.
That's a line of Adrian Rich's come to mind. What we see, and seeing is changing. Yeah. I mean, there is change and transformation in this at the heart of it. But, you know, here's a caller who said, it got me off booze, which is really what Bill W. thought it would do.
Yeah, and I mean, he's not alone. Like I said, there was research. I mean, there were dozens of studies of this in the 50s. And one study found that about 5% of hardcore alcoholics about 5% would recover with AA. And according to this letter I found from Bill Wilson, when he said preconditioned with LSD and put back into the supportive community of AA, these are Wilson's words, the results were staggering and went up to about 15%. So it tripled the – and this is, of course, short-term effectiveness. Yes. Who knows what happens. But there's something there. There's no doubt about it. This can help people, but like you say, I don't want to romanticize this. These drugs can also be dangerous, so we have to keep saying that. I think.
Well, here's Sequoia, who talks about wants to talk to us about the need for guides. Hi, Sequoia.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. I just want to say I grew up in the DARE generation, around a culture of fear of drugs and how bad that they could be for us and our bodies. And I since learned as I grew up that they're not always a terrible, terrible thing. And in fact, the plants and the plant spirits do have a lot to share with us and help us find our own inner light. However, that can be really traumatic if we have gone through some really hard things in life. And so I feel like it's really important for us to embrace it and embrace the possibilities and the power that these plants can bring for us, and have people who understand the process of where we might go and just be present with us if we feel like these are things that will help us through maybe alcoholism or other types of trauma that we're dealing with, maybe on an increasing basis.
All right. Let me thank you for your call. And you want to respond, Don Letton, to Sequoia's remarks?
Well, you know, what she said, I think it's good advice. And, you know, that study I mentioned of giving Iraqi war veterans ecstasy, MDMA, this is done with a therapist once or twice. It's not a drug you take every morning. And what they're basically doing is they're looking at their fear, the fear from the traumatic event they had in the military, and a new way for them to see that fear, understand that fear. So it's not that the drug is not really curing you. It's your own self-realization, which is triggered by the drug, which is killing you. But it's not really the drug that's helping you.
Let me thank her for the call, and we'll get Pauline on next. Pauline, join us. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. Morning. My name is Pauline Sebastopol, 8.5 years clean and sober in AA. And unfortunately, I came in late on this program, but I was struck when Don, first of all, my history growing up in the Bay Area, I did take acid as a young woman, and I always am so happy that I've had those experiences, because it was these momentary flashes of, oh my God, we really are connected. And I've always likened it to like a telescope through all of the poop and fear of life to that connection with the universe. And then I had to go into 35 years of hell to get clean and sober and begin to have a God of my understanding. But when Don speaks about the traditions of AA and says, you know, the only thing I have to be concerned with, my language, is his desire to stop drinking, let's remember Tradition 11, which is our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We should always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And so that's why I get nervous when one person might be on national radio possibly being interpreted as representing AA as a whole. But I'm delighted you've written this book, and I will be reading it.
Let me get a response from Don. We're running very short on time here, so I want
to... I hope I said, I do not represent AA in any way, shape, or form. I'm talking about my own personal experience. And yes, in a way, I disagree with some of the ideas AA has about anonymity, and I think I'm free to do that in the United States of America. But I also respect the reasons for this, and I could go into the historical reasons why AA has this, but we don't really have time.
Well, we don't, unfortunately, because there are a lot of people who want to talk about it, but we are... at the end of the hour here, and I want to give some plugs for where you're going to be. Again, this Saturday at 6 o'clock, Don and I will be together talking about spiritual matters.
And your book, Mike.
My book as well, Spiritual Envy. That's 582 Market Street. He'll be at the California Institute for Integral Studies, talking about psychedelics and the spiritual journey. That's Wednesday, October 17th at 7 o'clock over on Mission Street. And at Booksmith in the Hate, October 22nd, Book Passage in Corte Madera, October 23rd, and Books, Inc., October 24th, and your website.
Yes, donlatton.com.
Okay, you can find out about all that and more. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.